Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Joe Schwartz. I direct the university's Office for Science and Society. And our mandate really is to demystify science for the public, to separate sense from nonsense, foster critical thinking, and make sure that people are kept out of the clutches of charlatans. And that is exactly the kind of thing that we do with the annual Lorne Chartier Public Science Symposium, which is one of the university's premier events, and every year we invite top-notch speakers from around the world to try to demystify science, not only for our students, for our staff, but for the public at large as well. And we had our opening night last night, and I know that a number of you were here and enjoyed the talks, and you are also in for a treat today. But before we get on to the affairs of the evening, I'd like to introduce Professor Suzanne Fortier, who is McGill's new principal, to give you greetings. Professor Fortier comes to us from a previous position at NSERC, the National Science Engineering Research Council that she headed. Before that, she was vice principal, both research and academic, at Queen's University. She's a Quebec native. She was born here, and she's a McGill graduate. And who better than a McGill graduate to have the chance to run McGill? Professor Fortier is going to be installed officially next week as McGill's principal, and we are thrilled that she is able to join us here today to welcome you to this year's Lorne Chartier Public Science Symposium. So please welcome McGill's new principal, Suzanne Fortier.
Merci. Bonsoir et bienvenue. Welcome to the second day of the Trottier Symposium. On behalf of McGill, it is really a great pleasure to welcome you. I am myself just thrilled to be here. Many of you were here yesterday, so you know how exciting the conversation was yesterday. So I was very impatient to return this evening. Now, many of you have met me yesterday, and I'm afraid I will say some of the same things that I've said yesterday because there are people who were not able to be with us. Now, there are a number of things that are worth repeating, and so I think you'll agree with me that it is absolutely worth repeating that we are enormously grateful to Lorne Chartier and to the Chartier Family Foundation, who have made this exciting opportunity possible for us and for us here at McGill. You know that Lorne is a McGill engineering graduate. He's a great philanthropist. He's an entrepreneur. He's a dear friend of McGill. So merci beaucoup, Lorne. Over the past 9 years, the Trottier Symposium has become a touch point for spirited discussion and interchange of ideas here at McGill. And you know that many of you have participated in previous symposiums, so the topics are always enormously exciting and interesting, and they bring to the symposium world-class experts. There have been topics in the past on the origins of ethics, climate change, alternative medicine, food, and whether food and looking behind some of the science and not so scientific claim that are made sometimes about food. This year, the topic is that a fact, making sense of the headlines? We see headlines everywhere. In fact, whenever we walk down the streets, there are headlines on various publicity, of course, the web, TV, radio, newspapers, there are headlines everywhere. And it is very difficult for many of us to know if there's truth behind those headlines, and we will be helped by two more experts this evening in helping us make sense of what we are fed in terms of these headlines. You know, of course, yesterday were two very engaging lectures, so they set the bar very high for you this evening, but we are absolutely sure that you will, again, provide us with much food for thought. We have Timothy Caulfield and John Ioannidis who will be participating this evening. And those of you who were here last evening know that they'll make a presentation, but there will be plenty of room also for us to ask them the really tough questions. Now, I will introduce our moderator, Dr. Joe Schwartz, who is the director of McGill's University Office for Science and Society. He told me that I didn't need to introduce him again. In fact, yesterday, many people in the audience said, you don't need to introduce Joe, we all know Joe. I mean, he's on the radio, he's published many books, he's such a great contributor to bringing science to society that everybody knows Joe. So I won't say more about you. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
Well, thank you very much. I should have mentioned that perhaps Professor Forche's main qualification to run McGill is that she's a chemistry graduate. Okay. Fact. Those of you who were here last night saw that we defined them in one particular way. These are observations that sort of stand the test of time. That's what facts really are. Well, to kind of give a practical example, I mean, the observations have to be repeatable. But sometimes facts turn out not to have been facts at all. They may turn out to be wrong, and we have to kind of rethink them. But there are some things that don't change. We know that when an apple is detached from a tree, it will fall. That is a fact. Then, of course, we have a theory to explain that, and that theory is the theory of gravity. But what we then do with that fact and with that theory, that's a matter of interpretation. You know, what can be done with those facts? And that really is the essence of science. We gather all the facts and then we see what it is that we can do with them. The fact that bisphenol A, a chemical that many of you have probably heard about because it's been in the news so much, has that particular molecular structure is a fact. No matter where in the world any chemist studies this particular substance, they will determine that particular molecular structure. That's a fact. But whether or not tiny bits of that chemical leach out from bottles into babies' nourishment, and whether or not that has any effect on the development, that is not a fact. That is something that needs to be explored. However, sometimes it is presented to the public as if it were a fact that Canada, for example, withdrew baby bottles made of polycarbonate because it was a fact that it harmed babies. That is not the case. There were reasons to think about it, but it's not a fact that it was shown to be harmful. There are other things that are sort of less important. There's a story that I'm sure many of you heard because it's very popular in trivia circles and it floats around the web, that the flush toilet was invented by Thomas Crapper. It's a fascinating story because it would be great if that were true. You know, what a fascinating name for the inventor of the flush toilet. Well, that story comes from a book called Flush with Pride, and it was written sort of tongue-in-cheek. It's a very cleverly written book, but it is a parody. And I'm not sure what the author really was trying to do, maybe to convince people how easy it is to make them believe that something is factual that is not. It isn't. But the story was picked up, and it's now all over the web. And people are convinced that the toilet was invented by Thomas Crapper, and that's where our derogatory term comes from. It doesn't. I must say that over the past few years, I've had to use that word very often because of all the nonsense that is around. But that particular word was around long before Thomas Crapper. It does not derive from his name. Now, Crapper was a real person. He really did exist. He was an engineer, a sanitary engineer, and he did make improvements in plumbing. He did make improvements in the toilet, but he certainly did not invent it. But he was a real person. There's his grave. He's buried. We know all about that. Well, so there are facts that can be disputed and facts not. But these days it seems that we are kind of bludgeoned with facts or supposed facts on a daily basis. One day, vitamin D tells us, or the stories tell us, that it isn't really what we thought it was. It doesn't contribute to bone strength. Then we say, all right, well, we don't need it. The next day we find out, gee, you know, this is going to be the answer to diabetes. So we're buffeted back and forth by the winds of change. And we don't know who to believe, what to believe, especially when it comes to nutrition, because it's such a complex area. And going to take just a minute here to introduce you to something that McGill is just launching in order to get into this battle of what is a fact and what is not a fact. Many of you probably have heard of MOOCs. These are the massive open online courses. Thousands of people all over the world can sign up. And McGill is going to get into this. We're poking our toes into the water with the first course. And we are going to put this on through the chemistry department. And we're kind of looking for feedback on a promo that we put together. And we thought that this is a great place to use you guys as a focus group to test this out. So I'd like you to just take 1 minute, literally, and take a peek at this promo. And after, you can tell me or my colleagues, Dave Harpin and Ariel Fenster, what you actually think of this.
There are a lot of myths out there about food. We're bombarded by claims about miracle foods that we should be consuming or some poison we must avoid. Choosing which foods to eat can be confusing. To make good choices, we need good science. Join Professors David Harp, Joe Schwartz, and Ariel Fenster to learn more about the chemistry of food.
Well, I guess some of you like it. You can actually learn more about it, and you can even sign up. It's all free, and it's open access. And as you can see, there's Harvard. That's the McGill of the South. Berkeley, you know. So we're in kind of good company there. And it just takes a minute to sign up, and I think it's going to be an interesting experience. Well, before I introduce the speakers, the theme for the whole symposium this year really can be summarized in a couple of quotes. Aldous Huxley, the author, told us that facts do not cease to exist because they are ignored. And, of course, that happens so much in the world of pseudoscience. They just ignore the real scientific facts. But I'll leave you with one last quote, and it's one of my favorites because Sherlock Holmes is perhaps my favorite literary character. And really, that quote puts it all together. We have to make sure that we gather data properly and that we use the data to formulate our theories, not the other way around. We don't take the facts and try to make them suit the theory. And that really is the scientific method. This is what we're going to be exposed to here tonight. Professor John Ioannidis is a medical doctor. He comes to us from Stanford University in California. He has over 600 peer-reviewed publications, and those of you in academia can certainly appreciate what that is. But one of his most famous publications in 2005 has really raised attention all over the world, because this was a paper in which he examined scientific studies in general and came to the conclusion that a large number of peer-reviewed scientific studies are in fact flawed. And we have to be very careful in who we believe, what we believe, even in the scientific literature. He has numerous awards. He lectures all over the world, and we're very pleased to have him. I'm not going to go into details of biography because, of course, that's why we gave you the program. You can read up there. So he will follow Timothy Caulfield. Timothy comes to us from University of Alberta. His original training is law, but his expertise is in health policy. And his book, The Cure for Everything, is a Canadian bestseller, as you can imagine. How can it not be if you can propose you have the cure for everything? Of course, we will find out that it isn't exactly like that. He runs a large research operation. He, again, speaks all over the world. And not only is he very revealing about how the way science works, but he will present it in an extremely entertaining fashion. He has been the recipient, again, just like our other speakers, of numerous awards that you can read about in the program. So the format is going to be both of them will speak, and we will take questions and hopefully have answers after both have finished. So there will be no questions in between the two speakers. So I would like to call on Timothy Caulfield to get the evening going and inform us and entertain us and tell us how we can cure everything. My mistake. John is going to speak first. It's better than having made the mistake of putting the slides in the wrong order. And announcing the wrong order is better.
Thank you. It's really a great pleasure and an honor for me to participate in the Trottier Symposium. I think that I learned a lot yesterday. Based on what the other speakers told us. And I would like to start with a disclaimer, just to get the record straight. My talk is not about extremely well-replicated and contestable facts in science. You know, I'm not going to talk about evolution, climate change, tobacco causing lung cancer, HIV causing AIDS, things like that, whether measles vaccines is effective. There's a lot of such incontestable facts. I'm going to talk about the average paper, the average scientist, hardworking scientist, and the average headline that comes from a scientific paper. So here's how many such we have. We have over 15 million scientists publishing papers in major scientific journals in the last 15 years. This is from an analysis that we did recently with colleagues from the Map of Science. And we have more than 25 million papers published in the same period that are indexed. Actually, it's probably close to 100 million if you take non-Scopus index papers. Each paper can include anywhere from a few up to many millions of results. So I have 600 papers. Probably I have made, maybe a million claims of discoveries in my lifetime already. How many of those are correct? I'm an average scientist, 50% of that, 30% of that? To answer that question, I have to take one step back. And I have to say that most of us in science are under a lot of pressure. We're under a lot of pressure to deliver some very nice-looking papers that seem to be very rigorous. I'm not saying that we're not doing rigorous science, but in order to get them published and then in order to get funding to continue doing what we do, we need to come up with very nice papers. So the average scientific paper is about 6 or 7 pages long, and I cannot read you one such. But in analogy, I will read you a poem, and then I will explain to you how the analogy works. Poems can be very beautiful. Here's a poem by Sappho. Sappho, I swear, if I come not forth, I will love thee no more. O rise and shine upon us, and from thy bed set free thy beloved strength. And then with water by the bank, like the lily that dwells in the marsh, hold aloof thy Achaean robe and wash thee. And clays for thy adorning shall cast down from thy press saffron smock and purple robe. It looks very eloquent and very nice, but how is the raw data looking like? the real poem or the real scientific study, the real information based on which that poem or the scientific study that you see in a print journal developed. This is the raw data for that poem. It's a piece of a papyrus that was found in the desert because much of the Hellenic scientific and artistic heritage was destroyed in wars and by religious fanatics. And I'm going to read it to you. Pe her per peplon pis hechle sao rohoenda peplon porphyr dexo hlene pers stephani verhal osam fri porf tapa pai. Did you understand what I'm talking about? This is obviously Greek to you. But I want to convince you that the main problem is that it's not the language. It's not that it's Greek. This is a literal translation of that fragment. It's pretty different from what the poem that I read you is, but this is how the poem was developed by the translator. And this is pretty much what we see with science. We're trying to build very nice stories that withhold criticism, withhold peer review, would withhold scrutiny by funding agencies, that we've done our best. So is the medical literature in much better shape than the Papyrus Oxyrhynchus XV1787? I cannot answer that question based on poetry, but I will try to answer it with a little bit of cooking. So, diet causes cancer. Do you believe that? Personally, I do believe that. I head the Stanford Prevention Research Center, and one of the things that I say is that there are some things in our diet that could affect cancer risk. For example, I believe that if you eat more fruits and vegetables, or if you eat less bacon, probably you will decrease your cancer risk. But how many different foods would really cause cancer or protect from cancer? So along with John Schoenfeld, a very smart guy from Harvard, we decided to go to a cookbook. We went to the Boston Cookbook. It's been out there since the late 19th century. And we randomly picked 50 ingredients. We used the computer to generate random numbers. We went to the pages and picked random ingredients. Now we go to the scientific literature and peer-reviewed papers in PubMed, and we ask how many of those ingredients are associated in the literature with significantly increased or significantly decreased cancer risk. How many of those are studied, are under intense scientific investigation? Here's the answer. It looks like another poem. Veal, salt, pepper, spice, floor, egg, bread, pork, butter, tomato, lemon. Not so elegant. There's 40 out of 50. Actually, the other 10, it's just our mode of searching. So the way that we searched, we said that we're going to search for vanilla, and vanilla is not in the list. But if you check for vanillin, then vanillin would be associated with increased or decreased cancer risk in some studies. This is an apples and oranges and more type of meta-analysis. And I'm showing you here all of these ingredients and their types of relative risks that they have. So you have wine, tomatoes, tea, sugar, salt, potato, pork, onion, olive, milk, and so forth. And you have relative risks. And this is the 10 latest studies for each one of these ingredients. And I have plotted for you the results of these studies. What does a relative risk of 0.5 mean? These are relative risks for half a serving. Anyone wants to take a shot? It means that with one more serving, I can cut cancer risk to half. And a relative risk of 2 would mean that with one more serving, I will double the cancer risk. So how many of these studies do you think are correct? And now you may ask, what is correct? So I need to define that. So let's say we're within 5 or 10% of the correct estimate, whatever that might be. If we're more than 10%, it's not that it's completely wrong, but it's a bit far from accurate estimate of the risk. Well, we have to find out what the real risks are, and this is not easy. But for many of these ingredients, we have some very large studies. And the largest studies, for example, for fruits and vegetables, suggest that the relative risk is 0.99 per serving. If you want to plot 0.99, which is a 1% relative risk reduction, it would be right there in the vertical line of 1. I mean, it's almost indistinguishable. Is that important to know? It is very important to know, because 1% relative risk reduction, if you take it to the global population, we're talking about tens of thousands of people who would avert having cancer and dying of it. So it's important to know. But the estimates of these studies, almost all of them are way off from what seem to be the plausible and best evidence estimates that we have. And as you can see, most of the time they're on both sides. There are studies that show that many of these food ingredients are protective, and others that show that they're detrimental. I continue the same apples and oranges meta-analysis, and I'm plotting for you the p-values from these studies, the values of statistical significance. I'm showing you actually the standardized z-scores. The z-scores, for those who may not be very intensely acquainted to statistics, a value less than minus 2 and a value more than 2 means that you have a nominally statistically significant result. Can take a look at the distribution of the green values, the green being the p-values that have been recorded in the main results that are presented by the papers. There's a gap in the middle. There's really no action, hardly any studies that claim that they found non-significant results. There are many studies that found increased risk, statistically significant, decreased risk, statistically significant, even with the same food, but very little action in the middle of studies with no significant results. And then you read the papers, and you get some fine print information that seems to be primary outcomes that were not reported actually as such. And you see that you have this gray color distribution, which is that fine print that fills some of the middle ground. But most of the middle ground is still empty. What would I expect to see in reality? I would expect to see a normal looking distribution with a little bit of heavy tails, because there are some ingredients that would be strongly associated with cancer risk. I don't see that. I see a literature that almost everything that is reported and almost everything that is disseminated is nominally statistically significant. And this means that a lot of non-significant results have disappeared. If you go to meta-analysis, you will see that some of that gap, when you pull these studies together on the same ingredient, the same cancer, some of that middle gap would start filling up. But actually, it doesn't completely fill up. There's still a lot of missing action of negative results. Empirical studies suggest that most of the claimed statistically significant effects in traditional medical research are either false positive or substantially exaggerated. How do we know that? Well, we know that whenever we have tried to do replication with very well-designed studies, very large sample size, very rigorous methods. One occasion where this has happened is genetic epidemiology. And why was that the case? Because the cost of replication went down enormously. Genotyping costs went down about 100 million-fold over a few years. So we had the ability, instead of testing one hypothesis at a time, like one nutrient for one cancer, we could test the whole genome, millions and millions of gene variants for association with cancer or with depression or with diabetes or whatever else. And then we could do that with very large scale studies, and we could go back and check these associations that we had believed to be true in the past. How many of those, when we massively tested them with large consortia, survived? This is a list of survivors. We thought that we had found 57 genes for depression, 359 genes that would regulate smoking behavior, 150 for osteoporosis and so forth, and the last column is the replicated gene loci. The replication rate on average is 1.2%. Good luck, bad luck, I don't know. You know, maybe some other fields testing similarly one hypothesis at a time may have had a similar performance to genetic epidemiology, or worse or better. But at least for that field, it was 1.2%. Let's take a look at other types of discoveries outside of genetics. These are non-genetic biomarkers. Biomarkers are very important because if you can identify markers of risk, then you can personalize medicine. You can say that here's the person who will develop that condition or will respond well or not respond well to treatment. So this is an evaluation that we did of the most highly cited biomarkers other than genetic ones in the biomedical literature. And I have plotted for you the relative risk in the highly cited study and the relative risk in the largest study. Almost all the action is below the diagonal. What does this mean? It means that the largest study almost always, with a couple of exceptions, found much smaller effect sizes. The highly cited study suggests that these biomarkers are extremely important, very strong effects. You can use them, probably many of them, clinically. The large studies found that it's not that they're completely null. We do see some effects. They're not exactly relative risks of one, but they're much smaller than what we thought. And if it's a 1.1 or 1.2 or 1.4, it's questionable whether it's something that is ready to be used in the clinic. It's something that is interesting for the scientific sake of information, but maybe not yet prime time for the clinic. One might argue that, we're not going to use a single marker, but maybe we can build more complex models that use lots of information, clinical, genetic, non-genetic, and build predictive scores out of multiple pieces of information. So here's what it looks like for predictive models, multivariate models that use lots of pieces of information. I have plotted for you pretty similarly the performance of these models as expressed by an area under the curve for discrimination in the derivation study, the first study that proposed that predictive model, and the validation, AUC, in a study that was done subsequently to try to see how well that works in a different population. Again, you see that most of the action is below the diagonal, which means that the first study finds something that has exaggerated performance, exaggerated ability to predict compared to the subsequent study that is more conservative. There's also two colors here. There's validation studies by overlapping authors, so by the same authors who developed the model, and those by different authors. First of all, I have to tell you that in that literature, 5 years after a new predictive model has been developed, in 80% of the cases, no one has done another study to see what that model does. So 80% of the literature, there's a paper out there, usually in a very nice journal, but nobody cares about it. 5 years down the road, no one has tried to replicate, use, extend, apply, do anything with that in a different population. 10% of the time, it's the same authors only who try that again. And then another 10% of the time, it's different authors who try to validate the model. So a lot of inefficiency about information that could potentially be useful. Who would pay for replication? Would federal agencies pay for replication? That's tough, because there's a limited research budget, and we want to make more discoveries rather than say, well, we will replicate what other people did. But the industry has started paying more attention to replication. And the reason for that is that increasingly they have seen that academic research that comes their way is not reproduced. Why is that important for them? Well, they need to use that research to develop new treatments. And if it doesn't work once, twice, three times, they're in a very difficult position. So investigators from Amgen and Bayer recently published some very nice papers where they looked at a very large number of highly cited academic institution-derived research on drug targets and tried to see how many of those they could reproduce in their labs. The replication rate was 11% to 25%. So the vast majority of these seemingly wonderful research products could not really be replicated. In the case of Amgen, they could replicate only 6 of the 53 landmark studies. And their conclusion in a Nature paper last year was that the failure to win the war on cancer has been blamed on many factors, but recently a new culprit has emerged. Too many basic scientific discoveries are just wrong. This is a serious problem, and I think that one recognizes the seriousness further when you see what hedge funds start thinking about us. This is from a journal that I don't read every issue, but I came across that quote. I found it very interesting. At least 50% of published studies, even those in top-tier academic journals, cannot be repeated with the same conclusions by an industrial lab. The potential for not being able to reproduce academic data is a disincentive to early-stage investors. And at least one firm now is hiring contract research organizations to independently validate academic science prior to putting out serious money. This is a serious threat. If you take it literally, it means that as researchers, we are publishing because we want to publish, we want to get promoted, we want to get funding, but if you really want to do serious science, you need to do it from scratch. You need to do it again, otherwise it may be completely wrong. So we have to take care of that allegation very, very seriously. Some countries may be even worse in that regard. Last month, I published a paper in PNAS with Dan Fanelli, where we looked at whether there are some countries that produce more exaggerated results than other countries in some disciplines. We compared genetics, that for all the disadvantages that I mentioned earlier, has gone through a paradigm shift currently, and is very reliable in the current phase, and genetic measurements are very exact, they have a very small error rate, against behavioral sciences where measurements can be pretty creative. You know, how do you measure different behavioral aspects? We found that U.S. studies tend to have exaggerated results compared to studies from other countries. And I'm open to discuss what the explanations might be, but one possible explanation is that the pressure to publish and to deliver in U.S. science, where the careers of scientists are immediately dependent on securing more funding, is far more intense. I think this is becoming more prevalent in other countries as well, but this may be one explanation why we saw that pattern. Why research findings may not be credible? Some people may say it's fraud. No, I completely disagree. I don't think that these 15 million people went into science because they were fraudulent. You know, to become a scientist, it's a lot of hard work for many, many years. There's no end to it. It's very difficult. It's very demanding. If you want to, you know, become fraudulent, I don't know, maybe there's politics, there's lots of entrepreneurship type of questionable endeavors. But science, I mean, you know, it would be a waste of time. So I think that there's other reasons. I think that there's bias, and much of that bias could be unavoidable. And there's also random error. There's 15 million people running millions of analyses, huge multiplicity. How many biases are out there? I am probably an expert on bias, maybe. So I always wanted to come up with the concise encyclopedia of bias. And to do that, I had to read the entire biomedical literature. When I started, it was 17 million papers. I had been reading a few of them every night and getting slowly to target. And then David Chavalarias, a very brilliant physicist from the École Polytechnique, said, John, you know, that's very nice of you, but we can let the computer read the whole PubMed overnight. And this is a paradigmatic proximity map of biases in the biomedical literature based on text mining of information. 235 main biases that we could identify. How many of those I was aware of? Maybe a third. I'm an expert on bias, and two-thirds of them I had never even heard about. I did not know about. So when I'm designing a study, much of the time, I don't even know many of the biases that could happen. And I'm sure that I'm not the exception. There's lots of biases. Science is very difficult. It's very difficult to get rid of all of these biases all the time. This is another paper by Dan Fanelli. He's looking at how many papers in different scientific fields have statistically significant results. You can see a gradient here, and you can see that things like psychiatry, psychology, biomedical sciences, pharmacology, toxicology, have quote-unquote positive success rates of close to 100%, 90%, 95%. As compared to space science or physical science, that are about 60, 65%. Is it good or is it bad to have a lot of significant results? So Dan argues that it's bad. It means that there's huge pressure to just publish significant results no matter what. And he even creates a hierarchy of sciences. He says the sciences that create the highest proportion of significant results are the softer sciences, the less reliable compared to others that maybe have more stringent thresholds for claiming success. Discovery and replication. How could they work? Here's six different scenarios. Ideally, we want the discoveries to be correct and the replications to be correct. That's optimal. But it's okay if we have a discovery that's wrong and then we have the replication being correct. This is a self-correcting paradigm. We could have a correct discovery and a wrong replication sometimes. It can happen. The replication study may be flawed for whatever reason. Perpetuated fallacy means that we have a wrong discovery and nobody bothers replicating it for various reasons that I tried to explain, that we don't have time, we don't have funding, it's not a priority, or whatever. And challenge fallacy, the discovery is wrong and the replication is not done. Sorry, I mean, this is not done. The previous one was that the replication is done, but it was wrong. And unconfirmed or genuine discovery means that the discovery was correct, but again, we didn't have time, resources, or whatever, so the replication was not done. How common are these paradigms across different scientific fields? I argue that it's important to find out. And in some sciences, there have been efforts empirically to study how common these paradigms are. About a year ago, there was a whole issue in Perspectives on Psychological Science that had empirical studies in psychological science research trying to understand how common these patterns are. And I wrote the overarching paper at the end of the volume trying to put together these numbers, and this is how it looks like. Optimal, less than 1%. False non-replication, much less than 1%. Self-correcting, less than 1%. Perpetuated fallacy, about 2%. Unconfirmed genuine discovery, probably around 40-43%. And unchallenged fallacy, about 50-53%. Not very good numbers, and I can argue that there can be a lot of uncertainty about them. I'm not giving you any confidence intervals, and this is my fault. But obviously, there are numbers that we have to take very seriously and think on how we could improve that pattern. So how do we improve that pattern? There's many solutions, and we have tested a number of them in different settings, and they seem to work. The question is, can we transplant efficient paradigms to other disciplines and see them work? First of all, we have to learn to live with small or even tiny effects. This is a paper where we try to identify studies that have strongly significant results, but they describe relative risk of less than 1.05. There are several such, and there will be many more. And the more deeply we go into some fields, we realize that many of the things to be discovered pertain to modest, small, or even tiny effects that may be important to document. Some of them, like the fruits and vegetables example that I showed you, could even have a public health impact. A 1% reduction in cancer rate is not a trivial thing. But if it's a 1% reduction, we need studies that are very carefully designed, very accurate, in order to avoid the noise that would drown that 1%. There are a few large effects out there in medicine, but not that many. About a year ago, we looked at 85,000 medical interventions worth of information in forest plots of meta-analysis, including data from 220,000 randomized trials. This is the entire Cochrane database systematic reviews up to the point that we looked at these data. And we tried to see how many large effects are there for medical interventions. So one of the questions is, how often have we documented in several randomized trials treatments that decrease mortality risk by at least fivefold? They're highly statistically significant, p-value less than 0.001, and there's no evidence of bias that's clearly visible. Out of 85,000 interventions and topics that we studied, we found one. Extracorporeal oxygenation for babies. Is that all? Obviously not. There's several other medical interventions that are so hugely effective, like insulin, for example, or antibiotics like penicillin in many occasions. They were never tested in randomized trials because randomized trials were not there, had not been developed as a study design when they were found. But really to expect of medical scientists or any type of scientist that they can come up with a new insulin or a new penicillin every day, you know, among these 3 million papers that are being published every year, I think this is asking too much of us. I can almost promise you that I will not be able to come up with a new insulin or a new penicillin, at least in my career. Maybe some others might, but most of us, no matter how hard we work, we're not going to have this type of success. We will come up with some interventions that are effective. They could make a difference. They could have an incremental benefit. They could move science forward. They could have an impact in our society, but not necessarily save the world. Another solution, large-scale collaboration. The paradigm until recently has been that if you have a nice idea, you should go to your lab, close the door, don't talk to anyone, you become semi-paranoid, you have to work it out on your own, watching around to make sure that nobody listens, and then you have your Nature paper. I don't think that that works. For most questions, it's better to collaborate. It's better to have large studies with some agreement on how we do things, on what methods we use, on how we standardize analysis, and how we join forces. And this is one such large-scale collaboration on smoking behavior and genetic determinants. I told you that we thought we had found 359 genetic determinants of smoking behavior. So that was based on single small studies, each one an investigator closing their door and being siloed. And now we have a very large coalition of about 100 teams, sub-investigators with 200,000 participants worth of data, and we found three. None of these three were among the 359 that we thought that we had found. So the 359 evaporated. Those three have been repeatedly replicated again and again and again, and now, this is a paper that came out in 2010, we're up to about seven. Is that bad news? We thought that we had found 359 genes that regulate smoking, and now we know that we have found seven. I think it's good news because the 359 were irreproducible, and these seven are strongly reproducible. Everybody can replicate them and get the same signal. So they form a basis that we can start building some thinking about biology or possible interventions or things that we could do with that information. Improving research reporting standards could also make a difference. There's reporting standards about how to present research and make sure that all the pieces of information that is necessary to understand the study and what has been done are there. So there's things like CONCERT for randomized trials, STROBE for epidemiological studies, TREGA for genetic epidemiology, PRISMA for meta-analysis, MIAMI for microarray arrays. And there's EQUATOR, which is an effort to put together several hundreds of such reporting standards guidelines that try to improve the transparency of the information that is being presented. Registration, I think, could make a difference. What does it mean? It means that instead of being secretive about research, we can come up front with some ideas that we register in public, and we say that this is a study that we're doing. You should be aware of that. This is the protocol. This is the design. This is the analysis plan. This has been very successful in the case of randomized trials, where registration has been adopted for about 8 years now and has gone a long way to understand the dynamics of publication bias. When we see a randomized trial, we can go to clinicaltrials.gov and find out whether this is the only one that has been launched, or whether there is 3 of them, or 10 of them, or 100 of them that have been launched. For example, people were confused about what happened with Avandia and what happened with bevacizumab for breast cancer, where the drug got licensed and then the licensing was withdrawn. People would not have been so surprised if they would go to clinicaltrials.gov and they would have realized that there is 1,300 randomized trials that have been registered on bevacizumab. So if people take that into consideration, the possibility of getting surprised down the road, if there's pending data from hundreds of trials that are still in the making or halfway or not finished yet, is a reality. What could I do for studies that are not prospective designs that take years to be completed? How about like the idea that I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I run to my lab or I run to my computer and I do some experiments or even just click a button because I have a database and I look at a 2x2 table and I generate some association and then I publish that. Can I register this? It's highly exploratory research. So I would argue that for some type of research, if you consider that research, it's an exploration that happened at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it took me 2 seconds literally to test out hypotheses. Maybe there's going to be no registration. It's going to be level zero registration. But if I acknowledge that, you know, this is an idea that has no registration, then people would know, that's interesting. but it came out of the blue. So we'd better be cautious. We'd better try to have another study or several other studies by independent investigators trying to replicate this. Level one registration would be registering data sets. So I have that data set in my computer that is a large cohort study, and I will register what variables I have available so that people would know what is my potential for running different types of analysis in the future. Level two is registration or protocol, which means that I will register a specific idea along with a protocol of how exactly I'm going to address it. And people would know about that, that this is what John is doing. Level three is registration of the analysis plan, which is more than just the protocol. I can register the protocol, but the analysis plan is more than just the protocol. It shows the details about how exactly the analysis is going to be done. And for the same protocol, there can be lots of variants in the analysis that could really make a big difference in the final results. Level four, it could be registration of the analysis plan and raw data, which means that I give you everything. I also give you my data set with the individual level participant data, and you can take a look at that. And if you want to waste 4 months of your life to try to repeat all the calculations that I did, please go ahead. And then show me what you find. You may find the same result or a different result. And level five is open live streaming, which means that I go to my computer, I make it public. Everyone can see what analysis I'm running or what I'm thinking about or what protocol I'm drafting. I post that online, and people could immediately get back to me and tell me, John, this is a stupid idea. Before you do this, please fix this analysis or that item or change the eligibility criteria or change your protocol or don't use that concentration or do this or that. And I have immediate feedback with the whole scientific community that can tell me that this is a good idea or you need to fix that. So it's review in the making as science evolves. I'm not saying that all science could become open live streaming. I think that we have to decide in each scientific field which is the optimal distribution of research efforts. How many of those should stay at level zero? How many of them should move to level one or two or three or four, or maybe even open live streaming? Making raw data available, I think, could go a long way towards improving the transparency of science. Many journals have realized that this is very important. And this is an empirical study that we published a couple of years ago where we looked at the 50 highest impact factor journals in science across all sciences. There's a heavy tilt towards biomedicine, but it's not just biomedicine alone. And we asked the question, how many of those have policies in place that if you're doing microarray research or working on proteins or nucleic acids or micromolecular types of investigations, you need to deposit your individual raw data. You need to deposit your protocol. You need to deposit your analysis plan. And how many of those even make it a prerequisite to publication that unless you do that, the paper is not going to be published? And this is tiny font, but if you see green color, it means good news. It means that many of these journals have taken that openness and sharing of information and transparency very seriously. They do have policies in place for making information available at that level. But the last column, which has tiny, tiny font, you have to trust me that it has lots of zeros. And this is how many out of 10 papers that we randomly selected from each of these journals actually adhere to these policies. So the thinking about it is there. But how exactly to do it and make it functional is still something that is quite a challenge. So how much of that research would be reproducible if someone did spend the time to try to repeat what has been done? A couple of years ago, I got in touch with Miles Saxton, the editor-in-chief of Nature Genetics. It's the highest profile journal in genetics and one of the highest impact factor journals across all sciences, impact factor close to 45 or so. And Miles and his team have been visionaries in the field. Since 2004, they said, we're not going to publish microarray studies, which are very complex type of data, unless prior to publication you make everything publicly available. Data, analysis codes, software, protocols, we need everything to be reproducible. So we gathered four teams of microarray analysts around the world, the very best, and we told them, try to repeat the analysis of one single table or one single figure from published papers. Sometimes it took them more than a month or 2 months to reproduce the analysis in a single table or figure, and this is the results. 2 out of 18 papers could be reproduced. The others, they could reproduce with discrepancies. They could be reproduced from process data, but not from raw data with discrepancies. They could reproduce partially with some discrepancies, or most of the time they could not be reproduced at all. And the reason for that was that actually data was not available, even though it was supposed to be. The software was homemade and it had disappeared in the meanwhile. The methods were unclear, so four teams of microarray analysts could not understand what the methods were based on what was presented, or they got a very different result. We need more of that. We need more openness and testing transparency in research. And these are some initiatives. The Center for Open Science, the Reproducibility Initiative, they have launched efforts to reproduce samples in psychological science, samples in cell biology. We're launching an effort at Stanford, METRICS, the Meta Research Innovation Stanford Center at Stanford. And eventually, maybe what we should try to achieve is changing the reward system. What do we get rewarded for as scientists? If we get rewarded just for coming up with significant results, this is what we will deliver. What we need to come up is not just significant results, nominally significant results, but results that could be reproduced. So if we get rewarded for reproducible research, that could go a long way, and we have to think about how to do it. I will close just with a note of caveat about reproducibility and replication. We should avoid going to the other extreme of just doing too much. And here's one such example. Recently, along with Constantine Siontis and Tina Hernandez, we looked at meta-analysis published in the biomedical literature. We found that 70% of them have had at least one other meta-analysis published on exactly the same topic. And in some cases, there are just too many of them. For example, we found one topic, statins for prevention of atrial fibrillation after cardiac surgery, where literally there were 11 meta-analyses within 3 years, dealing with the same thing. The first one was inconclusive, but the other 10, they all found the same results. So we didn't really need that. Second note of caveat, we're living in a changing world. This is one field of meta-analysis. This is genetics. And the blue color showing the rise in the number of meta-analyses by country, it's not the U.S. or Canada, it's China. China was nowhere in that plot about 5 years ago. Currently, it produces about 60% of that research. And it produces five times more than the U.S., which used to be number one. Take a look at these papers. I took a look at them. They're wonderful. They're written with the best standards of American and European and Canadian science. They would pass muster. How about the results? They're about 100% wrong. Why is that? Well, because they completely ignore the vast amount of data that have been generated by consortia. They're just putting together little pieces of information from fragmented small studies that suffer from publication bias. So they do that very nicely. We taught them that. I taught them that. And it's just all wrong. So there's a very large number of conscious, unconscious, and subconscious biases that can operate in the research process. Replication and reproducibility practices vary across different research fields. And the adoption of these practices can be key to the success rates, efficacy, credibility, and legacy of each field. I think that science is doing great, but we can always do better. I will close just with thanking a number of my colleagues. I have worked with about 2,000 people who had the misery of co-authoring papers with me, and I'm just showing you some who have contributed to some of the empirical work that I showed you. Since I'm famous because much or most of my personal research is wrong, if anything was wrong in what I showed you, I take the blame for that. They should just get the glory. Thank you.
Well, good evening. First, I'd like to say it's a real pleasure to be here. It's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to speak to this diverse audience. And I'd like to start by thanking Joe and Emily and the Trache family for not only for the series, but for the fantastic, fantastic work that they do. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I think my talk fits perfectly with yours, John. But I am going to talk about the cure for everything. That's what Joe asked me to talk about. And so what do I mean by that? Well, this is a book I wrote because I became so insanely frustrated in my life as a health policy expert with all the baloney, all the crapola that we see in the popular press, but not only in the popular press, that we see in health policy discussions. Now, I dedicated this book to my wife, but she's not here because the book is really a love letter to science. And that is what that motivated me, and that's what I love so much about the Office of Science and Society, because it sort of fulfills that love. So what am I going to talk about tonight? Well, you know, when I wrote The Cure for Everything and the title came out, there were people that thought the title was literal. They really thought I was going to tell them what the cure for everything was. And I got hate mail saying, where the hell's the answer? I read your whole damn book and there's no cure in there. So I gave, you know, some talks, I traveled around, and that frustration was still in the audience. So tonight, I am going to tell you what the cure for everything is. All right. So when I did everyone know what that is? What movie? A very sophisticated audience. That's right, The Princess Bride. So that's me, actually. So for the book, I put myself through every chapter, right? So I went on a diet with the world's healthiest diet. I went on an exercise routine. I got my genes tested, John, at 23andMe. I went on all these different alternative medicines, etc., right? And the reason I wanted to do that is I was trying to search for the ideal healthy lifestyle, right? Because we're all searching for that. We're always told we should be searching for that, right? And at the end of my odyssey, and my goal was, I looked at all the literature, all the science I could. At the end of my odyssey, I determined that 95%, you can get 95% of the way to a healthy lifestyle doing five things. Okay? Five things. Everything else you hear, it's crap. So that's the term we're going to use tonight. Okay. And the funny thing is, in our lives, we hear about this 5%. We do a lot of the research on this 5%. There are careers built around trying to work on this 5%. And I think we really need to get back to the five things. So I'm going to tell you what I think the five things are. I think they're five evidence-based things, and they're phenomenally obvious. But that's sort of the point, okay? So you will leave here with the cure for everything. A big caveat when I start, now I don't really bring any conflicts of interest here, but I do have a tremendous bias. And I know it's a bias that Joe shares, and I know it's a bias that probably John shares, as you just heard, is I always start with the assumption that nothing works, okay? So I want, from now on, everyone should start with that assumption. Think of the diets. Think of the exercise routines. Think of the magic food. Think of the magic supplements. Over time, inevitably, we find out it doesn't work. So I have to have a lot of data to convince me otherwise, and so should you, and so should the Canadian public. So start with the assumption that nothing works. That's where I start from, and that's where I started from for the book. So I'm going to tell you what I think the five things are. I am going to also tell you what you can ignore, and there's lots, so I just picked a few of the things. I mean, you can ignore virtually everything, by the way. I'm going to tell you what some of the things I think you can ignore are. And then I'm going to tell you what some of the emerging things are. You know, there's five things, but, you know, there maybe should be six or seven or eight or nine, but we'll talk about that at the end. Some of the emerging stuff I think the data is building on. But before we start, and this is really where I do my research, our team does a lot of research on this, is I do want to come back to what John talked about, and our talks really do fit together well, as I said, is how did we get here? How did it get so confusing? How did the science get so distorted and so messed up? How come people don't know what's going on? Well, I think there's like this, there's this, what I call a hype pipeline or a cycle of hype. And it starts exactly where John said it starts. There you are, John. And by the way, John is one of my idols, right? So when I was told I was going to be on this panel, it's like someone saying, "You're going to sit next to Mick Jagger." And he kind of dresses like Mick, doesn't he? Like, but he really is. I mean, John, thank you so much for your brilliant, brilliant work. You know, we all are indebted to you. But what he just outlined is where it starts, right? The science, to begin with, has this distortion. It has these biases in it. Then the science, keep in mind, it just starts there, right? It just starts there. Then the scientists go to write it up. The science is going to start telling about it, distributing it. Lots of research tells us that as soon as they write it up, as soon as they write an abstract, you know, I have hundreds of articles, John has hundreds of articles, you put a bias in there, you put a spin on there. And I actually went back and looked at mine, and there is some spin and some bias in there, because you want to make it look sexy and exciting and also simplify it. So a lot of research tells us right in that abstract, which is written by the researchers, hype happens. So the reason you got the problems with the research, and the researchers write it up, it emerges. Then it goes to the research institutions like, you know, McGill, University of Alberta. They write a press release, right? And more hype there. And lots of research tells us hype goes into the press releases. This is another recent study. I'm sure John's familiar with this. At 50%, and I think they had quite a conservative definition, John, of spin. 50% of the press releases had some degree of hype in it. Then it goes to the media. We'll come back to that. Obviously, lots of hype and simplification there. Then let's say there is a product, whether it works or not, go more spin, more hype there, right? And then it gets to another place, which I find fascinating, and we're actually doing more work on it. I'm personally interested in it. When we see the data, when we interpret the data, there's also these biases, right, that John, there's these cognitive biases that emerge, right? We find stuff that we believe in, we have tremendously powerful biases that affect how we interpret the data. So I think there is this sort of, this hype pipeline that makes it all very, very, very difficult to know what's going on. Before I get to this, in addition to that, and John talked about how science is twisted, we also have to remember the kind of science that is used for a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about right now. A lot of the research, when you're talking about diet, when you're talking about exercise, when you're talking about magical food, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is correlation data, right? It's association studies. These are often big studies, but they find out what they're eating, and then they find out, you know, what happens to them, right? So I think you should always be careful of correlation studies. Here's one of my favorite correlation studies. Did you know there was a very strong correlation between how much chocolate you eat and how many Nobel Prizes you will win? So Canada McGill, maybe, you know, as principal, this should be your new policy. All your faculty should eat chocolate, and that will up the chances. It's a very strong correlation, right? And in fact, the data is even stronger, Suzanne. It's even stronger. If you want to get one of the big ones in physics, which we all know is the great prize, right? You eat dark chocolate. And here's the Nobel Prize winner, Eric Cornell, saying that he attributes essentially all of his success to the very large amount of chocolate that he consumed. And if you do want one in physics, you've got to go dark chocolate, unless you want one of those lesser ones like medicine, which is more of a soft science, you can go milk chocolate. Right? So he got in big trouble for that, and he retracted his comments. I made those rash remarks, a mistake. They were a mistake. We scientists should strive to maintain I love this neutrality from, you know, affiliation with either milk or dark chocolate. So I'm a milk chocolate man myself, by the way. Okay, so this kind of data I think is really important, and we should remember that. Okay, so whenever you see a study, is it an association study? Is it a correlation study? It's not that stuff's not important, it's valuable, it's a piece of a puzzle, right? It's not causative. Here's another great example of that. It's a chocolate theme here, Emily. I told you I'd have it, right? Chocolate theme. Emily gave me chocolate as a gift, and I was so glad because I do love it. But here's another great example. Do you guys remember this story? You got a lot of press. And this was a story that chocolate is calorie neutral, right? So not only is it good for you, you've seen those studies, but if you eat chocolate, you will get skinnier, right? The more chocolate, and the higher quality chocolate you eat, the more likely you are to get skinnier. What's going on there? Who buys high quality chocolate? It's a socioeconomic study, right? Really, I'm guessing, but probably, right, Joe? Right? So, you know, I love this, all the literature around this, but the fact that it's calorie neutral and you can eat as much chocolate as you, I love this message, by the way, don't get me wrong. You can eat as much as you want. So that's another really good example of how science can get twisted. Here's another great example. So we've moved from chocolate to wine. Remember this study? So drinking red wine will also make you slim. You can has a weight appetite suppressing quality, etc. So it's great. So if you want to lose weight, you eat chocolate and drink red wine. Where did this come from? Where does this study come from? What was the study? Who did the study? Maybe there are some participants in the audience. I doubt it because it was done on bees. So it's funny. I picture bees with a little Chardonnay and some cheese and maybe some dried fruit, and they're getting slimmer. But the funny thing is, this is a really good example of another thing that you should always watch for when you see a study reported in the paper. If it's an animal study, if it's an insect study for sure, but if it's an animal study, it's probably not going anywhere. John, it's like ridiculous, the transfer from an animal study to a clinical trial, right? Even if it makes it from an animal study to a clinical trial is a huge leap, and then that clinical trial actually resulting in something that has some benefit, incredibly small, right? I'm not saying this isn't useful or exciting or interesting, but don't put a lot of weight on it. And then here's one of John's other great studies. I mean, the man has published so much that also points out that there's a lot of bias in these studies, and I bet part of the bias is because of this pressure to get it to a clinical trial, right? You have to have the data to move on. So you have this kind of bias happening already. So before we get to the five, when you're reading a study, when you're looking at a paper, ask yourself, is this an association study? Is this just correlation data? Was it a small study? Was it an animal study? Are there conflicts of interest at play? I try to look for a body of evidence, but even there, it's not necessarily a slam dunk, but look for a body of evidence, look for sort of a trend of where the evidence is pointing, and I think that really helps. Okay, the other reason things are twisted, celebrity culture. Right? It's incredible, and this is actually something that we're studying now. I'm very interested in this. Everyone knows Jenny McCarthy, right? Everyone knows who Jenny McCarthy is. Jenny McCarthy has been a very vocal advocate of the anti-vaccine crowd. She has said absolutely ridiculous things, but she has an impact. She's had a tremendous impact. So you have people like Jenny McCarthy, and people hear this, right? You have sort of the other side of the story, Angela Jolie. Everyone saw this story, right? Everyone knows this. Angela Jolie had prophylactic mastectomies, got a huge amount of press. Now, we're actually just studying this, and I'm going to put up some data, and John's going to get mad at me because we haven't even done intercoder reliability, John. So no one repeat this. But we looked at all the representations of this story, and what we were interested in is, was the rarity of Angela Jolie's condition disclosed, right? Did the newspaper article tell the universe how rare her state is, her condition is? And we found in 68% of the time, there was no mention of rarity. So as I said, we have to replicate this, John. But that's the preliminary data that we have. Fascinating, right? Especially when you hear about how there are these anecdotal increase in people requesting both the surgery and the cancer testing. In fact, it's been called the Jolie effect. Have you guys heard this? There's people even calling it now the Jolie gene, right? Tremendous impact, and it has an impact on how people perceive this whole area, health. Another great example here's Gwyneth. Everyone knows Gwyneth Paltrow. Who does not know Gwyneth Paltrow? See, I told you, Joe, everyone would know Gwyneth. Gwyneth drives me nuts. This book is actually sitting on my desk. It's all good. Because I'm actually looking at a lot of her claims right now, so I see her face every single day. And its prettiness declines with each passing moment. She talks about using organic, and she smokes cigarettes to look vibrant, just to give that little bit of edge. That's incredibly irresponsible. She talks about detoxing and how important detoxing is. I actually went on Gwyneth's detox. I'd be happy to tell you about that in question period. So you have these kind of messages going out, and this has an impact on how people perceive health for sure. Here's another good example. This is Katy Perry. Everyone knows Katy Perry, right? You don't want to admit that you know who Katy Perry is, but Katy Perry, very, very well-known singer, and she's tweeting how she's all about supplements and living the vitamin life. People say, well, that's who cares. That may be innocuous. And she talks a lot about her vitamin intake, by the way. Who cares? How many followers does Katy Perry have? As of 3 hours ago, she has 46 million. So a lot of people are hearing about her life. By the way, she's catching up to Justin Bieber, just in case you're curious. He's number one. I know everyone was thinking that, that looks like Justin's numbers. He's getting close. She might even pass this week, so we'll follow that. Okay, so This has a tremendous impact. So given that, given all this noise out there, given all the twisted information that is out there, and then you have this added to it, right? Dr. Oz. We could go on about Dr. Oz for a week. The man drives me insane. His claims that he makes, and people listen to this. He's made claims about homeopathy. He's made claims about chiropractic and how it releases the energy of the body. He talks about fat-burning miracles all the time, and here he is down talking about detoxes. So you have this kind of messaging going out there. It's no surprise. Everyone is so confused, right? No surprise at all. And actually, there's a lot of interesting research that shows the degree to which people are confused. This is a study that was done in the U.S., and it asked people, how confused are you? I love this data. Americans find doing their taxes simpler than trying to figure out what they should eat or how to be healthy. Now, Arya Sharma, who's at the University of Alberta, he did a very similar study, got the exact same rate. I think it was like 93%, an incredible number of people that are completely confused about what to eat and how to stay fit. So given that, I hope today, right now, to go through the five things. And we're going to deconfuse you tonight. What are the five things? And we're going to go through them. So what's number one? And by the way, these are in rough order, I think, and we can argue, Joe, whether this is the right order. This is the rough order, I think, of impact on your health. And I told you guys, these are crazy obvious. Number one, don't smoke. Don't smoke. I'm sure there are physicians in the audience who have patients like this. They worry about GMOs and they don't want to have their tainted water and they smoke. If you smoke, it nullifies everything else in your life that you do. I mean, it's the single worst thing you can do for your health. It's just incredible, right? But despite that common knowledge, 17% of Canadians still smoke. And here's the shocking number. It's always good to remind ourselves of this. Smoking will kill half the people who do it. It's just really shocking numbers, right? Now, it's also depressing because that 17's held on, we're having trouble getting it down. There's a socioeconomic story there too. In addition to that, the tobacco companies are very nimble and they're figuring out new ways to get people interested in smoking. Here's some interesting data, maybe you saw this, right, about flavored cigarettes. And the other one is electronic cigarettes. I actually know adults that have started smoking because of electronic cigarettes, because they think it's benign. Now, we don't have data on it yet, but this is something that we need to research. So smoking, number one, told you it was obvious. Number two, someone already yelled it. Exercise, you're right, absolutely, exercise. Obvious, right? Now, the thing I want to inject in the exercise story, and not, there is a little bit of dispute in the literature, but I think that the literature, for me, when I look at it, the gestalt literature, I think we need to do it with intensity. I think there has to be a degree of intensity in your working out. I think there's a little bit of a moderation myth in there, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But exercise is just so phenomenally good for you. It's ridiculous, and I love this quote. It easily surpasses the effectiveness of any drug or other medical intervention. That is how powerful exercise is. It's incredible. And there has been studies, and some of them are better than others. But for sure, it has a profound impact on many chronic diseases. There are studies that say it's good for sex life. There are studies that are a number of interesting studies that are talking about its impact on Alzheimer's and as a preventative for dementia. Preventative step for dementia. There are a lot of studies about mental health. There are even studies, and John, these aren't the greatest studies, but I'm going to talk about them anyway because they're interesting, that it's good for grades. There was one interesting study that argued that it's better to have your kid do an hour of exercise than an hour of homework for your grades. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting message. And there's even a study from Sweden that says it increases your IQ. So look, it's really good for you. Everyone should be exercising all the time, okay? So clearly it's good for you. What is exercise not good for? Weight loss. It's not a great weight loss strategy. Do you guys know that? Yeah. So this is one of the myths associated with exercise. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Now, to be fair, there's some interesting data suggesting that intense exercise, particularly for men, reduces suppresses the appetite for a little bit, blah, blah, blah. But I think, in general, it's not a great weight loss strategy, and that's generally what the literature says. Why is that? Because it does increase your appetite. The other thing is people have overestimate to a great degree how many calories exercise burns. The story I love to use is... I used to take my daughter to ballet. I actually start the chapter this way. I drop her off at the ballet at school, and then I go to the cafe, and I get out my computer and start working, and I get the healthy muffin. It tasted like cardboard, but I thought, it's healthy. I'm gonna sacrifice. I get the healthy muffin, and I have a latte. This went on for a long time, three times a week. And I finally said to a new woman who was working at the cafe, you know, get me the healthy muffin. And she goes, healthy? And she pulls out the calories, 750 calories, three times a week. Add my latte, right? So that's almost 1,000 calories for my snack, right? Now, I would have to run for an hour really, really hard to burn off 1,000 calories, probably longer than an hour. And the rest of the day, I have to eat less than my body needs, right? No one does that. No one does that. If you play a game of basketball and you have half a Gatorade and a banana, you have consumed more calories than you burned, right? So it's very, very hard strategy. In addition to that, there are a whole bunch of forces out there that are pushing against us. Now, this whole idea about why people work out is very important because it becomes a very difficult public health message. We want people to exercise, right? We want people to exercise for their health, and everyone should do it, but the reason people exercise, and data tells us this, is for aesthetics. They do it to look good, right? That's why they do it. And we're told by people like Gwyneth, my friend Gwyneth, that you can do this. Gwyneth doesn't diet. And by the way, I did not Photoshop that image. That's really how skinny she is. She claims that she just works out and then she can eat what she wants, which is not true, right? It's just simply not true. Now, this idea of people working out for aesthetics I find is fascinating, and I said there's a lot of research that shows this, and this perception holds on late in life. I love this study. It wasn't a big study. It was a qualitative study. I think they did, the N was quite small, but nevertheless very interesting. So these were women between the ages of 65 and 90, and for that group, the reason they work out is to look good. Which is awesome, right? Good for them. But it's aesthetics, right? So that reason for working out holds on for a long time. The other problem, of course, is that there are many social forces and market forces that want us to believe that myth, right? Because they wanted to believe you can play a little bit of basketball with your daughter and then have a Coke, right? And that Coke is, 150 calories of, nothingness, right? You have Coca-Cola, all these companies often are associated with physical activities for that very reason. There's another interesting myth that I just threw in there, into the story, and this is the myth of ripped muscles and calorie burn. You guys heard this? I can eat what I want because I put on all these muscles and my muscles are burning up all the calories, or burning up the muffin I just ate. This is another big myth. Right. So, first of all, unless there are people in there, any men in the room under 25, males under 25. Okay, what I'm about to say doesn't apply to you. Everyone else, you are putting on muscle. Okay, it's extremely difficult unless you're a young male to put on any degree of muscle. So when you hear a woman who's worked out, sorry ladies, when you hear a woman work out and she says, I put on a little weight, but it's muscle, no, it's not, it's fat. It's very difficult to put on muscle. And in addition to that, your muscle does not burn a lot. It doesn't burn a lot. And this is actually data that's hard to find. I had to dig and dig and dig. And there's a little bit of disagreement in the literature, believe it or not, about how much a pound of muscle burns. But if I worked out really, really hard for a year, and I've devoted myself to this, I might be able to put on 10 pounds of lean muscle, okay, as a middle-aged man. If I actually achieve that goal, I could eat one more Oreo a day. That's how much calories is burned. So don't believe this myth either, okay? All right. The other thing I think is very, very important is resistance training. I really believe that the literature says everyone should do this, and I mean real resistance training. And this is something, again, that's sort of de-emphasized. It's starting to creep in now. You started seeing it more in public health messaging, but it's de-emphasized because, again, I think it scares a lot of people. But I think the literature really says that resistance training throughout your life is incredibly important. Even if there may be endurance athletes in the room that don't do it, it benefits endurance athletes. And the other important thing is to do this with intensity also. Okay, so that's exercise. What's number three? Oh, we heard eat less, it's getting close. Food, eat better, someone said it. Eat real food. Now, we could go on and on. You can talk about this for a month. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to make one claim, and we'll see if people agree with this, and we can maybe have a discussion, Joe, after about whether you agree with this. There's so much noise out there around food. There's so much noise. I really believe that we should strip it down to one simple message, and I really believe if Canadians ate, if 50% went in your mouth, and you watched the number of calories, but if 50% went in your mouth as a real fruit or a vegetable, we'd cause a sea change, right? So I think that, if we just started with that simple message, it would truly make a difference. So eating more fruits and vegetables, as John said already. In addition to that, you can ignore all the baloney that abound, baloney, I didn't mean to make that pun, all the baloney about superfoods, including bacon, which we love at the Caulfield House. Bacon's a big deal, so we love this headline. But I truly believe there are no superfoods. There are no superfoods. You see these claims all the time. It really is about a balanced diet, because every superfood, you know, goes from that to some horror story about. Now, I have four kids, so I'm thinking maybe I should have eaten more bacon, but it was a perfect, you know, example that Joe started with. Okay, so more fruits and vegetables. In addition to that, of course, I know it's such a sad picture. It's just incredible how far we've come. That could have been me, by the way. I think my mom probably did that. She would have had a martini and a smoke at the same time. But the other thing, so you have to eat better, eat real food, and we could talk about exactly what I mean by that in the discussion. But in addition to that, you do have to avoid the junk. You have to avoid the junk. And this is also where I think there's a moderation myth. And this moderation myth is also, I think, sold by some degree by the corporations, but also because public health messaging is afraid of saying this. Look, if you have a plate of food in front of you, and you eat junk every day, right? There really is not a lot of room in a healthy diet for junk every day. I'm not saying you can never have junk, but you can't make it part of your lifestyle. And I think this moderation myth, it tries to perpetuate that. So you got to avoid the junk. I know this is tremendously obvious, but I think this is what the evidence says. Now, in addition to that, just the extra calories, the empty calories, etc., there is some emerging evidence. I think it's very speculative right now. But still interesting about sort of other effects of eating junk food that we should be aware of, including the fact that it might have an impact on the bacteria in our gut. This idea, again, very, 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 very early stage, because this is fMRI studies, and a lot of these, the number of patients involved are very, very small. But still interesting, this idea that eating junk food might even rewire how we think about food. So a lot of reasons to avoid junk or to avoid making it a regular part of your life. Okay, what's number four? Now, someone yelled it out already. And this is probably the most difficult and the one that is probably most controversial. Well, someone said sleep. Can we park that one? That's a good one. It's weight management. Now, I used to hear say weight loss, but it is virtually impossible. Did you guys know it's so depressing when you look at the data? But it's weight management. Now, there are some arguments, maybe you've heard about the fit versus fat debate. There's some arguments around that in the literature. But I do think that the bulk of the data says that maintaining your weight or striving to lose weight is worthwhile. And as a result of that, there have been a huge number of campaigns out there to try to get people to be aware. There's my muffin, I guess, right? To get aware of what you're supposed to eat. So the data is really shocking. People underreport their daily calorie intake by about 20 to 25%. So you're eating right now probably, unless you're keeping a diet diary, about 20 to 25% more than you think you are. Now, what's interesting is when I did the book, I ate 40% more than I thought I did. I was really bad, 40% more than I thought I did. The other thing is people underestimate calories by 100%. This is true, and this has been replicated in this study, even experts. So if you go into a restaurant and you see a plate of food and you think it's 400 calories, it's 800 calories. So double everything. Now, I have a favorite restaurant I go to when I'm traveling, and I go in and I order the chicken Santa Fe salad. So maybe you even know the restaurant I'm referring to. And I thought it was 400 calories. It's 1,000 calories. So this, everyone does this, right? Fewer than 1 in 10 can correctly guess the number of calories they eat in a day. Do you guys know how many you should be eating? This is Arya Sharma's data, by the way. He does great stuff. You know, generally speaking, it's between 1,800 and 2,200 a day. Women less, men more. If you're really active, a little bit more, but not as much as people think. Like, it's the bell curve is pretty tight. I'll skip over that. And then, of course, there's this phenomenon of optimistic bias. This is another bias that's going on. Does everyone know what I mean by optimistic bias? So what happens here is people go, yeah, I'm aware of all this data, and I shouldn't smoke, and I should eat right. But you know what? That's not a problem for me. Right? That's a problem for everyone else. And everybody does this. The data is really strong. Everyone has these kind of biases in place. So there, as a result of that, there are all these interesting campaigns. This is a relatively recent one from LA saying, look, you only should have about 2,000 calories a day. Here's the kind of calories that, you know, give you a sense of what's going in your mouth and the calories involved. I think that's a cool idea. I don't know how effective it's actually going to be because we're incredibly good at compensation behavior. Here's a very recent one from the UK where they're, again, trying to say how much activity you have to do in order to burn off a bunch of calories. A lot of these campaigns don't work because people are very, very good at tricking themselves into eating more. So what they do is they pay attention when they're mowing the lawn, but the rest of the day they just eat what they want, right? They just worry about burning off that Big Mac, and data shows that that's what happens. It really comes down to calories. I won't go into details about this, but again, we can talk about this during the question period. But I know you hear about all these diets, you hear about all these different ways of losing weight. There is things at the margin. There are genetics at the margin. There is metabolism at the margin. There are these things that make you feel kinds of food that perhaps make you feel more satiated, et cetera, et cetera. But at its core, it really is calories in, calories out. You know, that's really what weight loss is about. And you have to find a diet. And I don't even like the word diet. I think it should be lifestyle. A lifestyle that you can maintain forever. Otherwise, you're doomed to fail. Now, the other important thing here, I talked about these cognitive biases at the beginning. This is another big problem, right? We have so many delusions about the universe. Humans are terrible at perceiving the universe. Isn't that right? I mean, that's one of the reasons we have science, right? To cut through our inability to see what's really going on. And one of the delusions we have is what we look like. Did you guys know that? You have no idea what you look like. So there's a lot of guys in the audience, a lot of guys here. I can absolutely guarantee you guys that you are all shorter, fatter, and uglier than you think you are. Absolutely guarantee it. Okay? I was, by the way. They've actually studied this. And there's just one kind of funny study. Most of us think are way hotter than we are, particularly guys. Now, women are far, far more complex animals. I'm not even going to venture into that territory. Because you all both think you're ugly and hot at the same time. I don't know how you do that. It's like positive and negative particles. Yeah, I don't know how it works. But let's stay with the simple species, men. And all of us guys think we're really good looking. We think we're really, really hot. They ask over 20,000 people to rate themselves, guys, on a scale of 1 to 10, and they averaged around 7, right? Think about that. That means that over half the guys think they're an 8, right? You guys, that's mathematically impossible. Half of you are uglier than the other half, okay? Full stop, right? There's probably a bell curve distribution of looks. Now, my brother, who's a physicist, said, whoa, Tim, you're being kind of hard here. That's not necessarily true. There could be a really ugly group of men at the bottom, right? Right? Making room at the top for more sevens. And I said, that's a very good point, Case. You're, you know, more scientific than I am. We have to consider other sports, right? All the sports. And the entire country of Sweden. And it becomes a much more... Have you been to Sweden? It's true. It's ridiculous. I felt like a troll. I was there. They didn't even... I went to get jeans, and they didn't have jeans my size. This was the troll section. I had to go down these stairs. Anyway, but this has real implications, right? Because remember, why do we work out? We work out for aesthetics. And I could have I picked looks, but you could pick other things, right? You could pick height. You could pick a lot of different things. Do you know guys on average lie by an inch? We're talking about height, by the way. by about an inch. Every guy in this room is an inch shorter than they say they are. I did the same thing. I thought it was 5'11". I know people are laughing. What, 5'11"? You look like you're 5'8". Okay. So, but this phenomenon has been with us for a very, very long time. And my brother's an artist, so I love to, he gives me these works. And I asked him for this one because it really demonstrates how long we've been obsessed with abs, right? How long. I think this picture is fascinating for a bunch of reasons. Also because, what's that guy looking at? And he looks really shocked, too, like, oh, Zeus, my goodness. But it really is about aesthetics. It's sadly so, and the market plays to that. The market plays to that. It's about sexy abs. It's about sex. So that really becomes difficult from a public health perspective. It becomes difficult from any kind of messaging to get across the idea, look, you should be working out. You should be adopting a healthy lifestyle for health, for lifestyle reasons. And it is, it's funny, but it's a real challenge. It is a real challenge. Now, I didn't want to pass, this is my nemesis, I love M&Ms. I didn't want to make this a diet advice talk, but I do want to pass on some bits of advice. I used to eat a bag of M&Ms every time I went to a movie. One of those movie bags is 1,200 calories. So I have like 800 calories left in a day if I have that. It's just incredible. And people aren't aware of that. But anyway, it's all about lifestyle. Portion sizes, I know it's boring to hear that. Diet diary, I think that is one of the single most effective things that a human being can do. In fact, all diets work this way. All gimmick diets work based on the diet diary principle. People start thinking about what's going in their mouth for a change, for a period of time, they eat fewer calories, they lose weight. That's how every diet works. So you think you want to get into an industry to make money? Get in the diet industry, because no matter what you suggest is going to work for a short amount of time, because of the principle of the diet diary. But you don't need to do that. Just try keeping a diet diary. It has a huge effect. This is my one gimmick. Avoid liquid calories. The juicing fad drives me nuts. Data tells us that liquid calories are not satiating. They're just a very efficient way to get calories in your body. Don't eat. Don't drink any liquid calories. I avoid all liquid calories except for beer. And then breakfast. Now, this is a very interesting story because when I wrote the book, I thought the data was settled on breakfast, that breakfast was good for you, John, right? The data, you've probably heard this. Everyone should eat breakfast, you'll eat fewer calories during the day. In fact, the data is quite unsettled. It's becoming more unsettled. Now, this is a great article that was in the New York Times. I won't go into any detail on this, but I recommend this article because it does a great job of talking about how the data can get twisted and how myths can emerge. And the breakfast myth is one of them. And if you know what I mean by the breakfast myth, that you should eat a healthy breakfast. Now, I still think it's kind of true. I like to have a big, healthy breakfast. I have the same breakfast every day. But from a scientific perspective, that myth is starting to erode. So the fifth one I'll do very quickly. It's probably going to surprise you a little bit. I think it's injury prevention. Just simple, straight up injury. If you want to have an impact on your health, put a helmet on, wear a seatbelt, don't get on a trampoline. I think and from this perspective, I think it's fascinating the risk perceptions that people have. We were talking about this over dinner. I have neighbors that won't let their kids walk on the street because they're worried about getting abducted by, the white van, right? They don't eat GMOs, but they got a trampoline, right? The risk ratio is just completely out of proportion, right? So obvious one. I'll skip over that. Okay, so those are my five. Now, I'll go quickly, Joe, over this last part. Some emerging things. We already heard some of them. I think sleep. I think the data on sleep is really emerging. I actually think this is going to be the future public health concern. None of us sleep enough. The lack of sleep seems to be associated with a lot of social ills, including obesity, including a number of other chronic diseases. The other one I'm fascinated in, and Joe and I were talking about this, and the data is just starting to emerge. I was very skeptical at first, but this is the standing stuff. Have you guys heard this? That we all sit too much. You guys are sitting now. we all sit too much. So that is another field I'm starting to buy into it, this idea that we should stand more often. And the last one is, and I don't really like it because it's so very resistant to it because it sounds kind of new agey and kind of touchy-feely, but I think the data is it's true. And this is relationships. I think relationships really do have a huge impact on your health. Might be correlation data, but I think there's a lot of it out there that says that, you know, having good relationships really does have a long-term impact. So I might add those to my five in the future. But I do think sleep is probably the next big one that will move up. Okay, things not to worry about. Really quick, I could have picked 1,000. I'm going to start with ones that we've already talked about, vitamins, right? I think these have been completely oversold. I think that very rarely, and the evidence is mounting that this is the facts, but very rarely do we need to take supplements or vitamins. In fact, they may often be bad for you. You should be getting your vitamins through your food that you eat. Right? And if you do that, you probably don't need any supplements. In fact, I think you rarely need any supplements. Now, as I'm saying that, people are thinking of two vitamins, one already shown, vitamin D and omega-3, right? Now, what I'm going to say about these two is the data on their effectiveness and value is way, way more equivocal than is often portrayed in the popular press. I think the data on vitamin D is unfolding, but you know what, you guys? It's way more uncertain than you probably think. And I think that's the same with omega-3. And of course, if you eat too many of these, there can be some real health risks. The last one I'll pick on here is also, I get a lot of hate mail over this one. What do you think I'm going to put up? What something to ignore, don't worry about. Organic food, very close. Organic food. There's no evidence. This is the study from Stanford. And you know what? It's funny this study got so much attention, but there really has been no data for a very long time. There's no evidence organic food has any higher nutritional value at all. I mean, that just isn't there. In addition to that, you know, if you eat a lot of organic food, it'll make you a jerk. This was an actual study they did. And you know the phenomenon, right? I drove my Prius to the farmer's market to give birth to my baby in a tub. But they were actually trying to investigate, you know, what are the motivations for people eating organic food. And you know, look, we buy our food at a farmer's market. We think it tastes better. But you know what? Actual double-blind studies have shown that for most foods it doesn't taste better, which is fascinating. Anyway, you get the idea. There's no evidence that you should be focusing on organic food. I also think you can avoid almost all high-tech solutions. We do a lot of work on genetic testing. No evidence that you get any big benefit from that. Of course, you avoid all gimmicks. You guys know that, right? You have a very sophisticated audience. There's Suzanne Summers for you, just for you, Joe. You know, avoid all those myths. Ignore Dr. Oz. Your butt is not going to get toned by wearing shoes. Sorry to pass that on to you. In fact, that was a lost lawsuit. Did you guys know that? The Reeboks, those shoes, the big fat shoes that people wore. And, you know, you ignore myths like 8 glasses a day and all the diet fads, of course. Look, if you ate all your food through your nose, you would lose weight. And the last diet fad I'll put up is, this is supposed to be Madonna's diet, and it's called the Air Diet. So apparently whenever Madonna feels hungry, she pretends like she's eating. And just going through the motions makes her feel better. Okay, so as I said, I'm almost done. As I said, why these are all so obvious, why bring them up? Why talk about them? Well, because virtually nobody is doing them, right? It's incredible how few people do these activities. Here's a study from the U.S. It says only 5% of Americans do any vigorous physical activity. I think it's actually less than that. But almost no one's doing exercise. Almost no one's eating enough. Less than 7% of Canadians get the appropriate amount of exercise. And that's the minimal standard set by the government. No one's doing it. What do you think the number one moderate activity of Americans is? What do you think it is? What do you think the activity is? The number one moderate activity. Someone's walking. It's not sex. Not walking. Last time I was at a talk, they said masturbation. He did look fit, so. The number one modern activity in the United States, food preparation. So when we live in this kind of world, right, we live in this kind of world, we've got to emphasize these basic things. We've got to ignore the 5%. Here was a study that was done by the American Medical Association where they had, now they had seven, yeah, they had seven items, and they said only 1 in 1,000 Americans does all seven. So we've got to get that message out there. Don't smoke, vigorous exercise, real food, weight management, prevention, a little bit of sleep, love someone, and you're going to be good to go. So thank you very, very much.
Great speakers. I love it when they agree with me. A couple of weeks from now, the wheat belly guy is going to be speaking by coincidence in this room, nothing to do with us, but I can guarantee you it's going to be filled to the rafters because he will promise the cure for everything is in avoiding gluten. Because non-science sells more than science, unfortunately. Anyway, you got a mouthful of science here, and I know that many of you are going to take away different things from, you know, what learned here today. I know many of you are intrigued by the fact that exercise actually improves your sex life. I think that's probably a good selling point. I know what my wife is going to take away from here today. The chocolate allows you to lose weight, and but I know that she's been practicing this. I mean, she doesn't know that I know, but I know that she hides the chocolate in the linen closet. And, of course, what she doesn't know also, that I eat it and replace it. So, okay, I'm sure that this is fodder for a lot of questions. And so we will open the floor. Please walk up to the mic if you have a question. And the same rule holds as for last night. Please don't make a speech. But if you have a legitimate question that you want to ask, now is the time to do it. And tradition has it that we allow Lauren, who is the benefactor of all of this happening, to perhaps lead off with a question.
Okay, so we heard from John Ioannidis there about how many bad studies there are, studies that appear to find effects that are turn out not to be true. And so in the light of that kind of thing, how should we view studies about substances that people claim cause harmful health effects, like trace chemicals in the environment, pesticides, bisphenol A? So there's a lot of concern about those things where there's some studies seem to show harmful effects. How much of that should we believe? How should that be taken?
I think this is a very interesting question. And much of that research obviously is done with standards of observational epidemiology because it's not easy to randomize someone to something harmful. That would give the impression that we're treating people as guinea pigs and trying to kill them. So with that limitation being acknowledged, the best that we can do is make sure that these studies are done with very rigorous designs and they're reported without selective pressure on cherry-picking results, and they're independently replicated, and there's some consensus and standardization in the field. Is this happening? Much of the time it is not happening. So many of these results would be pretty spurious, and they would probably see some improvement in their credibility if we're able to come up with these better standards in the conduct of that research. Now, one might argue that if it's for serious harms, maybe we should be cautious, and if people claim that this is a serious harm that could affect millions in the population, maybe we should do something and maybe even have public policy waiting for the more final results to emerge, but there has to be some agreement in the community about what the standards of these studies should be. And I think that we can aim for a higher threshold and some better clarity in these results rather than having lots of waves of confusion arising again and again.
Yes, in front.
Dr. John, I liked your approach when you talked about the levels of checking and enumerating things, but we have lots of universities out there and lots of students in science, and I've often heard of studies in pairs where two universities will do the exact same study, and I think that that would be an approach into then publishing a paper and using maybe your levels. Why is that not more used?
I think that this is one approach that could fulfill some replication requirement. I think that there are some fields that use replication as a standard, and they would perform this not just two studies, but multiple studies being designed with similar methods and with similar analytical approaches and trying to see whether the results square with each other at the end of the day. I agree that it's the exception, though. There's probably many reasons for that. Maybe there's the perception that just trying to do the same study is not very creative and very inspiring. Maybe some funding agencies may have difficulty to accept this type of approach. Maybe some scientific fields are not so familiar with the need for better standards for replication. But I would argue that based on what we have seen in fields that have adopted replication standards and have improved their credibility substantially, a shift towards more efficient use of replication practices could make a difference. I think it's an issue of convincing the scientific community and funding agencies and journals and funders within specific disciplines that could really affect the eventual credibility of the results.
Yes, next.
When I was in Akko in Israel a few years ago, there was a merchant there, and he was selling pomegranate juice. But his English was very minimal, and he wasn't saying pomegranate juice. He was grinding the pomegranates, and he was going, antioxidants, antioxidants, antioxidants. People were flocking. I thought of that today when I reached in the fridge, and I reached for yogurt, and I looked at the different fruits, and I reached for the blueberry, because antioxidants. Now, when I heard about omega-3, I'm very unsure about the antioxidants. Is that also, the research on that also very shaky?
I think it is. The research is not shaky on that. So the idea is that we do need antioxidants, and antioxidants can be good, but you know that they can also be bad. I think what is sort of shaky is the selling of antioxidants, the pushing of antioxidants. If you are eating a balanced diet, if you're eating appropriately, your antioxidant situation is probably covered. And by the way, coffee's got a lot of antioxidants in it, so if you drink your espresso, you're probably good. Yeah, I do think it's oversold, and Joe could probably comment on this too.
Antioxidant potential is very easy to measure in the laboratory. So there are all kinds of tables and documents on the antioxidant potential, the free radical scavenging ability of a food. But it's certainly a stretch to take that value, which is called the ORAC value, which is really an academic kind of finding, and goad people into believing that the 2.5 blueberries that are put into one cup of yogurt are going to have any kind of health effect. In science, we always emphasize numbers. Everything revolves around numbers. So to me, the first question always to ask when someone says that such and such a thing is good for you, you have to ask, well, how much of the unpalatable stuff do you have to choke down? And the next question to ask is that if you do manage to do that, to choke it down, what is the effect that it is going to have expressed in terms of numbers? So, yes, the antioxidant thing is out there all the time. I mean, you see labels, antioxidant, everywhere. And it is correct in the sense that we can demonstrate in a laboratory that such a thing does have an antioxidant effect. But whether or not that has a clinical significance, that's a completely different question. What we know, as Timothy mentioned, is that fruits and vegetables are good for us. And indeed, if 50% of the calories in our diet came from there, that would be great. The sort of seductive interpretation of that is that it's because of the antioxidants. Nobody really knows that. It's sort of the collage of chemicals that are found in fruits and vegetables that are good for us. But the antioxidant thing is a good marketing gimmick, and when it's used to market fresh fruits and vegetables, it's great. But when you put it on some, you know, cereal, because you sprinkled, you know, a few micrograms of some blueberry extract in there, then it's meaningless. And in fact, you'll find that there's a cereal that, well, we can name it, why not? It's out there, it's called Total. And they have on the label pictures of blueberries and blue, you know, antioxidants and everything. And you look on the list of ingredients, there's no blueberry in there. What they do have is some flavoring, and it's called natural flavoring, and that might have some trivial amount of blueberry flavoring in there. So you know, science, as they say, is in the details.
Hi, my question is directed towards Dr. Ioannidis. Big fan of your work, by the way. But as a undergraduate student at McGill, and naturally I'm science oriented and I read a lot of science papers, and in this day and age every new thing that comes out seems to be an innovation or ground laying work or a breakthrough, some research breakthrough, and I read paper the research behind it, and I think, wow, that's a load of crap, that's actually not new, someone did that before. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that from my perspective and other young scientists' perspective, it seems like in this day and age, the free open science is a way of, well, I shouldn't say free open science, free private science is a way of progress, like quick, rapid progress in human history. Like if you look at today's day and age, we're making more progress than we did, let's say, 2-3 decades ago. So to young scientists like myself and people a few years older, it seems like your method of levels is slowing down human progress. And my question to you is, how do you present that to the public to show that actually this is a more efficient way of making progress rather than having the, let's say, everybody is the next Einstein approach to it that we currently have today?
That's a great question, and I have to admit that there's many ways that one could intervene in the way that science is being done and have the best of intentions and end up doing more harm than good. So, for example, how do you improve peer review? How do you improve pre-publication peer review? How do you improve post-publication peer review? How do you improve standards of reporting? How do you improve reproducibility checks? And most of the things that I mentioned, do we have experimental studies about them? That we know that we have randomized scientists to follow one track or another track and in an experimental manner make sure that one group does much better compared to the other. We don't really have that. I mean, most of our systems of operation within science, they have evolved semi-naturally or even opportunistically, I would say. We do some things because we have tended to do them that way, and one interpretation is that the way science would evolve is just the best, by definition. That we don't need to worry about it. That we'll do the best possible under the circumstances to promote science. It's one possibility, but I have some reservations about whether that's really the best. I mean, we have several lines of evidence and several empirical studies that show that some of our current systems don't work very efficiently, and others seem to be working more efficiently. So I'm more than eager to try to test many of these ideas more experimentally. And some fields are very impassionate and they cannot wait. So they say, we want to go with open data sharing, and then they see an acceleration of the way that they produce information and they validate information and they replicate or refute information. So it seems to me that there's no way that there will be a perfect recipe that would be easily recognizable, but at least trying to work with some of the ideas, especially ideas that have worked in specific disciplines, could make sense. And the plan would not be to slow down scientific investigation. The plan would be to accelerate and improve its efficiency.
I make a very quick comment because I know a lot of questions, but it's a very scary time for science right now.
in Canada. There's tremendous pressure now to commercialize. I'm looking at this is our, the new principal. It's very, very intense. And that kind of pressure to commercialize, we're actually studying this at the Health Law Institute, creates increased pressure to translate more quickly, increased pressure to have these quick answers. There are institutions in Canada, funding agencies, that want to see answers in 5 years. You can't ask science to do that, but we're creating an environment, I think, that is ripe for disaster.
Okay, next please.
My question is for Dr. Ioannidis. There was a recent sting operation where a fake paper was put together with a fake author and some really bad data. And it was submitted to a huge number of open access journals. A shocking number of them accepted it for publication. Of course, it was published in Science, which is a traditional journal, so there's a bit of a bias there. I was wondering if you had personally looked at the quality of open access journals versus traditional journals.
This is a very interesting question. There's no good research that compares head-to-head open access journals versus subscription journals. To me, the question is almost a moot point because currently it seems that the prevailing paradigm that will move forward to the future seems to be open access. And what does it mean? It just means that the information is available to people to read the paper without having a subscription. It's the authors who are paying rather than subscribers to the journal. I think that what you described could very well have happened with traditional journals of similar quality to the open access journals that were tested in the hoax paper. I think that there's probably about 100,000 journals circulating out there that claim to have some scientific orientation and using peer review. Many of them, especially that new generation of quote-unquote open access papers, they're just money-making machines, no more than that. They have no idea about the science, and they don't care about the science. They just want to make money out of getting $3,000 or $4,000 per paper that they accept. And I wasn't really surprised to see that result, that 55% of these journals accepted a paper that was completely fake, had ridiculous results, and anyone who would read that for 2 minutes would see that it's completely wrong. It just says something about the quality of much of the information that is surviving quote-unquote peer review and gets out there. And it's really very scary under the current environment. You will see lots of nonsense being published in these journals and many others.
Okay, the last two questions there.
My question is for Dr. Ioannidis. So a lot of studies which the pseudoscience in the media is based on some kind of scientific study which they quote or which they rely on. So I guess some responsibility then goes to so-called scientific studies which is hyped upon later on. So my question really is, the first question is that do you think that there should be some responsibility of the funding bodies or the government or some kind of regulatory body to have kind of control or regulate such kind of information which can have such a wide impact on public health and whatever uses? And my second related question is that when you looked at reproducibility and replicability, do you find a bias for applied research versus basic research or any of the physical sciences versus biological sciences or something? Does that tell something?
Very interesting questions. I think that there is responsibility at all levels of disseminating scientific information. There's responsibility at the level of the scientist, of the funding agency, the journal, whether it would publish the paper, the funders who want to make some story out of that somehow. And that pressure and that competition for very limited resources is really permeating the whole system. So funding agencies are also under a lot of pressure. They need to prove to politicians or the government or whoever is funding them that they're producing something very important, and they're using taxpayers' money very efficiently, and they come up with major discoveries, and look at all the Nobel Prizes that NIH has funded. And I think that this is very dangerous. It's asking for scientists to go out of the real realm, which is being very careful, hardworking, and skeptical, towards making big claims. And these claims could be made by scientists, they could be made by funding agencies sometimes. So you end up having situations like NASA making press releases that they have identified arsenic-using bacteria that suggest that there's alien life. And this is probably an extraordinary claim. I can sympathize with the need to show that we're making such great progress, but then when that story is refuted down the road, it's really a shame, because people then will not trust the next press release, or they will be very skeptical about it. Regarding the second question, there's clearly differences across different scientific fields. And the thresholds of adopting a discovery and saying that, yes, that's very likely to be true, are very different. So many of the observational epidemiology studies have very low thresholds of accepting associations as facts. And this has been very damaging to them, because then you have other studies that show that they're wrong, and the replication rate is very low. Other sciences, like most of the physical sciences, they have much more stringent thresholds. So they go for a 5 sigma or 6 sigma compared to a 1.96 sigma for traditional epidemiology. What does it mean? It means that it's far more likely that something that comes out of more stringent discovery processes will be true and likely to survive replication procedures. Also, some of these other sciences, they may have a different culture, in that if you fail, which means if you claim something and then this is overturned, it doesn't look very good. Your career will be damaged, and your reputation will be at some threat if you claim that you found a new galaxy and this doesn't end up being the case. As compared to other fields where people are just publishing tons of papers and 90% of them get refuted and nobody says anything about them, they will say, oh, that's okay, we'll do more of that. So there are disciplines that have very different thresholds. I think that some disciplines could learn from others and maybe improve their practices. How exactly to do that efficiently, I think, is open for research.
Okay, last question, please.
All right, so there's currently an initiative. This is a question towards Timothy Caulfield. So there's currently an initiative in Washington State to push towards producers labeling GMO foods. And so I know there's a lot of misinformation going around GMO foods and their dangers, but I also believe that the public should be informed about what they're buying. But I don't want them to put unnecessary emphasis on things that might not matter. What do you think?
Is that a Sex Pistols t-shirt you have on?
Yeah, it is.
That's an awesome album.
Thank you.
So even though you have a Sex Pistols t-shirt on, you're wrong. No. I do think there's a huge amount of misinformation about GMOs out there. Now, and in fact, one of my PhD students is looking at this very question of labeling. And here's the challenge. So if you ask people, do they want to know, they say yes, right? So the issue is, should the state mandate the labeling of food based on something that's not scientifically proven? So there's no if the threshold normally for labeling is health, right? That's in most jurisdictions around the world, particularly Canada, the United States, the threshold for labeling is there a health risk to it? And there is no evidence that that's the case with GMOs, right? Mm-hmm. So the labeling would be based on this right to know idea. But we don't mandate, we can't, can you in a liberal democracy require that of food producers, right? Let's say people wanted to know something crazy, I want to know if this food was touched by the hands of some particular kind of people, right? And everyone wants to know it. Should the state require that kind of labeling? It's a very tough question that sort of permeates beyond GMOs. I think the answer is, I personally think it's no. Even voluntary labeling becomes problematic, right? Because then you have to have, what is GMOs? You have to define GMOs. You have to have trace back to the source. It becomes very, very problematic. The studies have shown that GMO-free is viewed positively by the public, and contains GMOs is viewed as a warning. And so it becomes, I do think it's problematic, and I personally think that we should stick with a science-based labeling system.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. We will, of course, do it all over again next year with a different theme, different topic, and certainly we're happy to have suggestions about what it is that you would like to hear about. So if you can just send those along to us by the electronic media, we're certainly happy to hear that. Check out our website, OSS McGill, easily find it. And as you can appreciate, to put on, you know, something like this takes a lot of work. It actually takes much more work than anyone who hasn't done it can appreciate. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that has to be done in order to make such a thing happen. And luckily, we do have someone who does a fantastic job behind the scenes, and that's Emily Shore. So I'd like to recognize her for really... for putting it all together. But Emily, there's more work to do, because I see that Gwyneth Paltrow has 46 million Twitter followers, so we have some catching up to do, right? So let's get out there and tweet. And what is the hashtag for tweeting here?
Tonight, if anyone was tweeting, they should be tweeting Trotty Fact. So you can continue that. But really, if everyone followed us, we'd slowly get up to Gwyneth. So.
I don't know what she just said. I'm sure that those who are younger than 25, of course, do know this. So. I think we had two fascinating days. I think we learned a lot, and I certainly did. So I think maybe we give our speakers one more round of applause. Now let's get out there and eat that chocolate. So we'll see you next year.